The best view is from the bleachers. From the Bleachers Podcast with AJ and AJ.
Time to give them the old razzle dazzle.
From the Bleachers Podcast, AJ Knight, AJ Salveson. AJ being selfish on the road, doing that sports thing, getting some coaching reps in. Sheesh, man.
It's not that nice. I mean, I'm driving from Reno, so take that for what it is.
Well, you know, I said last week that you're one of the better-looking baseball coaches I've ever seen. It only makes sense that you get some work in with a college football team. But based on your experience, you know, 1 year, one freshman region championship, that's, to me, establishing a culture. Let's talk World Series here.
Okay, yeah, I'm down for that.
Now that we've had some time to let this set in, I think the biggest thing, still to me, the takeaway is Kershaw. Because, look, you're a Braves fan, so you watched him come back, the Dodgers, at least 3-1 this year. I'm a Cubs fan, so there's plenty of bump-ins that the Cubs and Dodgers have had, especially during the Cubs run. Legacy's out there for him. The label has been one of the most dominant regular season pitchers. You can get to him in the postseason. And he pitched pretty well in the World Series, so to you, is the label removed? Just him pitching pretty solid and winning that one ring, take the label of choker off?
That's what the complaint usually is, right? If they can win a ring, that'd be the case here. I mean, I remember back when Steve Young had won a ring, he lost back-to-back NFC championship games to Dallas. You know, they always said he couldn't win the big game. So when he finally did and he beat San Diego, everyone considered him a Hall of Famer. It's funny how that works. And I think that's the case with Kershaw. You know, he hadn't won one. He hadn't actually really played that well until now. And like you said, he had a great World Series, so it gave him a chance to be able to, you know, get the monkey off his back. And, yeah, I would definitely take the label off now, definitely.
Do you think it diminishes it at all? Not that he took a step back, but for him, that's still really good. But do you think it diminishes it at all that they finally won one when he was more, I don't want to say downside, because I think he's still a really effective pitcher, but not like in his tip-top prime?
He still started. He still pitched quality innings too. If anybody has that kind of theory, then there's just no way. There's absolutely no way you can have that thought of, especially after the way he pitched in the World Series. That's insane.
Fine.
That's unfair too, actually.
I won't have that thought. I'm just throwing it out there. I just think that he's not at his prime. Like the year that they lost back-to-back, granted, it was only a couple years ago, but, I mean, he was just insane during the regular season. One of those years, I believe, when they lost to Boston and Houston, one of those years of the year, I think he won the MVP, wasn't it? So he's not far removed. I just think you could tell he's, again, I don't want to say downside because he's still super good. Just thought maybe not starting to head down the slope. He hit the peak and he's coming down.
Well, if he's coming down, it's a pretty nice way to come down then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to complain about Frank. Frankly, if I could right? if I could be James Jones and just ride LeBron's coattails to a couple rings.
There you go.
I ain't gonna lie. I mean, 10 years from now, everybody's back. You were on a championship team? Look at the gold right here. Well, granted, I talk up AJ's coaching a lot now. I don't want to offend coaches other places, but with you coaching freshman baseball, one of the big criticisms of the World Series was Tampa obviously going with the analytics in Game 6 and pulling their pitcher when he was cooking. So from your perspective, again, as coaching a freshman high school baseball team, what did you make of that?
Interesting. They had that bloop single off of him, right? That was a 9-hitter. And then they had the top of the order coming back. The point was 0-for-6. I think it was actually 0-for-9 with 6 strikeouts. Like, they just had something like that. They just kind of hit, I mean, they hadn't hit well at all. I think Snell should have got well at least one more, at least one more batter. I think that should at least be seen. And depending on how that at bat went, if he gets an out, he stays in. If that singles, even if he singles or if he draws a walk, you pull Snell. But he's, 75 pitches, 6 innings is a dream for a pitching coach, like, right? I mean, that's 75 pitches through, or yeah, with the 6 innings, it's a dream for any manager to have that situation. They pulled him too quickly. That's just, and there's no good excuse for it. Analytics, you throw it out the window, it's an elimination game in the World Series, and you say, look, you go to your guy and you say, how do you feel? And he says, I feel good. You say, okay, look, you're on a short leash. You got one batter, you know, per guy. You're going to take one batter at a time. And if you get hit hard, then we're going to pull you. They should at least give him bets. And whatever bets did, then if you get three bets, you get Seager, should give him a chance. And that's just unfortunate.
You know, that's the way I kind of lean to the analytics. I feel like it's one of those things where statistics mean a lot to a group of people, but not a person. And then the argument obviously would be, okay, well, the analytics is what got us to Game 6 of the World Series. But I feel like that's the difference, I feel like, between an experienced manager and not. You can recognize maybe in the moment, be like, all right, I know what the numbers say, but I'm watching my guy. He's cooking. We're going to give him one more. Because like you said, that single, too, that even got the guy on base, and they were immediately like, all right, he's done, was kind of a bloop single, which is just some, you know, as they say, sometimes it's just you get lucky where you hit him. Sometimes you hit him really hard and the right at people. Sometimes you barely tap him and it's just nobody's there. So I'm with you. I mean, from your experience, and again, I don't want to offend coaches anywhere. I play up Audrey's base coaching experience all the time, but your perspective on it, maybe you have something similar that happened to you or how you see it actually coaching a baseball team.
Yeah, again, I think like you said, I love how you brought up the single too. It's something where, I mean, you can throw the best pitch ever and a guy's going to find a way to fend it off and put it where nobody else is. That's just how baseball is. That's how great hitters are. I'm not calling the number 9 hitter for the Dodgers great by any means, but sometimes a blind mouse finds a piece of cheese, and that's what the number 9 hitter did. That was enough to scare Kevin Cash to take out Snell, which, again, just it dumbfounded me that you don't give him one more batter. And again, if Mookie Betts hits him hard, then you pull him. If he walks him, you pull him. But if he gets him out, give him rope. And he didn't. And I would say that cost the Rays Game 6 of World Series. That alone cost him Game 6.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how mad are you at L.A.? Because, like, we've got this kind of co-dynasty going in pro sports right now, right? Because the Tampa Bay Lightning won the NHL. The Lakers won the NBA. The Dodgers won the MLB against Tampa. The Bucks look pretty good for the NFL. The Rams are all right. How much do we hate L.A. right now? Because Tampa, I feel like it's impossible to hate. They don't win a ton. L.A. is a history of winning a bunch of crap. Like, they suck.
If you're Boston, you hate L.A. if you're Green Bay, Wisconsin probably hate L.A. But now I feel like the Lakers title did make me bitter. I wasn't happy about it. I didn't like it. But this Dodgers won, you know, they come back 3-1 against the Braves, fight their way back. You know, they're in a battle with the Rays, fight their way back in that one, win that. I just there's a little bit more genuinity. I don't know what the word is. It's more genuine in Dodgers style than it was the Lakers style. I'll say that. It didn't bug me as much, not even as near as much. But you're right. I still freaking hate LA. You're damn right on that.
I mean, it's got to be like them 1-2 LA Boston, something like that. All right, let's. While we're on the subject, then let's get some perspective from an LA fan. We will
rock you. Who else is in the bleachers?
Give me my tickets.
50 fans from 50 states. We will rock you.
From the Bleachers Podcast, happy to welcome in Chris Wren from Sports with a Guy Named Chris. Thank you so much for being our fan this week from L.A.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be in L.A. right now.
That's my first question is how awesome is it being an L.A. fan? I mean, you already got two chips this year.
Yeah. The COVID thing, it kind of, you know, felt like nothing could possibly go right this year, and then lo and behold, LeBron brought us to the promised land, and Dave Roberts finally didn't outdo himself managing, and you know, we got there, and it's been so dang long. I started thinking maybe it wasn't going to happen in my lifetime again.
Well, okay, so speaking of the Dodgers, talk to me about Kershaw, because I'm sure for you, just as frustrating, but anyone who's a fan of baseball probably knows him as kind of two different pitchers. Arguably one of the most dominant regular season pitchers of all time, but postseason, and as a Cubs fan, I've seen it firsthand. What did this, in your eyes, mean to Kershaw to get that championship?
You know, I think it just put the final little bit of icing on the cake. You know, I mean, you know, he's a first ballot Hall of Fame shoe-in, but he needed to get that. He needed to get that chip. And, you know, with everything that happened with the Astros a few years back, and I felt like we were right there and right on the cusp, and he was looking good. And then all of a sudden it went where it went. This year, it felt sweet. I was glad they, that Dave pulled him when he did, even in the sixth inning after 5 2/3 innings or whatever. I was thrilled. I was like, this is a good time to get him out.
So as an LA fan, because that's been kind of, I think the analysis has been that they've just been, they've relied on him too much. It's not so much, not as much that he's choked. It's just he's been stressed too much. Given being a fan, is that the perspective you have as well? That for Kershaw, it's just, it was too taxing. He was in short days rest. He was in a closer, and they were just counting on him too much?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that Dave has the tendency towards mismanaging and counting on Kershaw a lot, just like he did with Kinley. And, you know, you can't bring guys in for six out closed saves all the time, and you can't bring a guy on 3 days rest every time and expect him to perform at the same level.
So with the Lakers championship, the Dodgers championship, obviously the Dodgers, first one since the 80s, the Lakers have come back and kind of really bottoming out. Which one went more to you?
For me, it was the Lakers. I mean, even though it's been 32 years for my Dodgers, there's been, you know, there's a lot of Laker hate out there, and, sure. And I deal with it a lot online and elsewhere, and it's nice, especially having the Clippers in town here, seeing them go out in the second round and us finish it off. That was pretty sweet, okay?
No, I want to talk about that. Tell me about these L.A. rivalries. Really, I think the most serious one would be that one, because the Chargers, meh, the Angels in California, meh. But the Clippers one, that one has become so much more interesting. From an L.A. fan, from an L.A. Lakers fan, what do you make of Kawhi and the bunch?
You know, hey, if they blamed it on Doc, so they got him out of there, so they got rid of a decent coach for nothing.
Yeah.
Ty Lue, I was glad we didn't get him when we offered him the crummy contract of 3 years a couple years ago, and he turned that down. And then we ended up getting Vogel. I was happy with that. And as far as the Clippers go, I mean, you know, I think Snoop Dogg said it best. They're like that adopted brother you don't want. No, the Clippers, they just talked it up. You know, maybe they should go ahead and get a chip once before they say that we own L.A. and we're the kings of L.A. and Kawhi does commercials with the crown on his keychain.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they should win one first.
So for you, I want to keep talking about the Lakers, because obviously there's one big thing besides the championship that happened this year. But so obviously the Lakers, there's a lot of hate. I feel like the Yankees, I feel like, in the basketball world, they have a lot of great players. They attract the great players. How does the championship fit LeBron into the weaving of the Lakers? Because obviously you've got the homegrown ones like Magic Johnson and Kobe, but you've also got the Kareems that have come along, the Shaqs that have come along. LA has a history of some of the best players that have ever played. So how does LeBron fit into all that?
Well, I mean, this definitely gets them up in the rafters. They're going to hang a jersey one day. As far as the pantheon of Laker greats, I'm not going to put him there yet. He's that great a player, just not as a Laker yet. But winning the chip definitely goes a long way. I think, you know, if he retires here and doesn't go back to Cleveland for a final season at the very end, just to, you know, I think that would go a long way towards cementing his, you know, Laker greatness. But just getting the chip alone, that does it. I mean, that gets him in the talk. But, you know, I don't put him in there ahead of Kareem or Shaq or any of, or Kobe or Madge. But maybe, you know, right now, Biff, and dang, he's only played here 2 seasons, so that ain't bad, right?
No, you can win a chip every 2 seasons. I think most people would take that.
Yeah.
So for you, I want to ask you about Kobe, but for you, before we get to that, who is the greatest Laker then? Because that's always a great discussion with all the great players they've had that have had success there.
Okay, well, my hero is Magic Johnson. He was, you know, the one growing up that I looked up to, and he retired early, and I always felt like he was the greatest Laker. I would have to just say it's 1A and 1B with Kobe and Madge. I just feel like, you know, the longevity of Kobe, closing it out with a 60-point game, you know, all that.
Well, then I feel like you could say that I think what LeBron has done for this generation, probably the generation before, Kobe just made – he was the face. There's no denying that. He was the one ever – I think you would – the player that stands out to – basketball fans and non-basketball fans from a generation. I think he picked it up from Michael, and then LeBron picked it up from Kobe.
Absolutely. There was a baton pass there.
Yeah. So, obviously, no denying. But everyone, I think, felt that because Kobe had transitioned so seamlessly, become such a great interview, and he wasn't in the public eye a ton, but it was always great to see him. Being in L.A., what was that like with Kobe passing? Because it's obviously, with even with all the crap that has gone on in 2020, still one of the things I think for most people will stand out as one of the worst that happened.
Absolutely. You know, this may make me sound weak, but I still cry at least once a week. I mean, I cried for a couple weeks straight. I took 3 days off work to grieve. It was probably, you know, I mean, I haven't had anybody really close to me die. It was probably one of the most devastating things that's ever happened to me. And the whole city, it was, the pall that it placed over the city was insane. And I personally received hundreds of texts and messages, either Facebook or text, regarding it. And it's just every time I got one, you know, people are like, well, how do you feel about it? I'm like, this, just hearing about it again, even thinking about it, is so depressing. So it has definitely been a challenge just to remain optimistic this year.
What was your favorite Kobe memory? Because obviously I think you have much more of an attachment as an LA fan.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I guess the exultation that he felt when we walked off the floor against the Celtics, when we got that chip and we finally got past them with Kobe by himself, and him having, like, I think he was 6 for 24 in that game, but he had like 15 or 17 rebounds, and he found a different way to win when he didn't really have it going offensively. I think that was the pinnacle moment for me.
And the one,
and obviously the 81 too.
Oh yeah, who can't remember that? Sorry, Toronto. One of the great things makes us fan is just the impact it has on our life. So you talked about Kobe. For you, all LA fans, favorite moment, favorite player?
I think the Gibson home run.
Ooh, okay.
You know, I mean, he's not my favorite player, but the Gibson home run was the biggest moment in my mind. And maybe the Magic Johnson skyhook in 86. Those were the, yeah. Maybe that was 85, but those were the two biggest moments. My favorite baseball was definitely Steve Garvey, Mr. Clean. Basketball, you know, like I said, it's Magic and Kobe, but it's just the Lakers in general, you know, that love that I have for them. And, gosh, what a great year to be an L.A. man.
Thanks for rubbing it in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you Cubbies got yours, okay? I've had to listen to it for the last 5 years, all right?
Okay. Then tell me this, because obviously there's this weird co-dynasty in the sports world that LA and Tampa have this year. Chances, the legit chance, because everyone knows the Bucks' perspectives in the NFL. It's the last major championship for the season. What are the odds for the Rams? Fandom or not, I'll decide your bias when you tell me your answer, but what are the odds of the Rams here running a Super Bowl?
5%.
5%.
You know, okay. Before last week, I was thinking we could make a run to the Super Bowl, probably not win it, but we could definitely get, you know, but after that shellacking we took to the mighty Dolphins, I'm not feeling really optimistic this week or this month, you know?
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on, talking with us about LA sports. Where can people find you?
If you go to Facebook, Sports with a Guy Named Chris, you can probably find me. It's probably a little bit of a difficult search because I haven't been on there a lot, but I'm going to post up your podcast when I see it, and I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I guess enjoy, really. I mean, I'm trying to be as complimentary as possible without making myself sad because I watched the Cubs implode again and all of my other teams are completely mismanaged. But, you know, I'll enjoy. You got to enjoy.
I appreciate you, brother.
Thank you again to Chris, our fan from L.A., who's just got to be riding, you know, sky high. Two championships already. The Rams, a decent shot. The Clayton Kershaw been a big focus of this podcast, recapping the World Series. And again, the big thing is you take one of the greatest pitchers, one of the greatest competitors in his sport, and he's had success, and it becomes a story you focus on because, like, is he a choker? Now, Ajay, there's a couple, though. So my game here for you this week is the Close Call Legacy Club. So Kershaw obviously was in there, and I think we're fitting the definition of somebody who's been pretty good in the regular season and then just seems to flame out in the postseason. So I'll give you some names here. And you put them in an order to me who's the biggest choker, because Kershaw gets to bail out, and now we got all these other ones. So to me, one of the ones, and you're ranking them, but I'm just for to me, one of the ones that's got to be in the top now, James Harden, possibly one of the greatest scorers ever in the NBA, quite notable for his flameouts in the postseason.
Okay.
Another one close to home for you while we're talking NBA. How about John Stockton and Karl Malone?
I hate you.
Very good jest. He's going to get it done. Maybe not so much a choker, but, man, this year hadn't helped the Falcons, and that 28-3 is not something they're ever going to shake off. How about Matt Ryan? Had a chance to win the Super Bowl, won an MVP, and then this year I think just further drives home. Maybe not the choking thing, but then blowing leads doesn't help that. Dan Marino, Hall of Famer, made it to one. Never seemed to be really a threat, despite being probably ranked for most, one of the better throwers of the football. How about Jim Kelly and those Buffalo Bills teams? Four straight Super Bowls, big old bagel. What do you think, Jay? Rank them here. Give me the chokers. Give me the ones that I'm being too hard on in this close call club.
This might surprise you a bit, but James Harden is dead last on my list.
Of choking?
He's dead last. I'm going to put, oh my gosh. You know, okay, so this is going to be kind of, I'm actually going to put, are we putting Stockton and Malone together, right?
You can split them up if you want. I just figured since there's run with so much together, they're kind of a pair.
Yeah, no, I like that. So I'm going to put Stockton and Malone number one, and I'll explain to you why, because it's the exact same reason I have Matt Ryan at number two.
Okay.
I have Tim Kelly at three, Dan Marino's four, and James Harden's five. So, and here's why. So you have Stockton Malone, who went to three or four Western Conference Finals, lost to the Sonics in seven games in 96, lost to a loaded, I don't know if it's actually loaded, but lost to a good Rockets team in, I think, 94, lost to, choked against Golden State in 92, 93, I think. 92, I think, is when they lost to the Blazers. Not a blame for that one. That Blazers game was loaded. They were so good. But they choked at Golden State in the first round. That was a bad loss in the early 90s. Mavericks, they lost to. That was a horrible loss. I blame them for that one. So I put Stockton Malone first. Matt Ryan, almost for a similar reason. Here's why. Matt Ryan's been a number one seed how many times? And how many times have they get beat out in the division round? Lost to the wild card Packers 1 year, lost to the Panthers, I believe, lost to, I mean, they found different ways to lose in at times when they were the number one team going into the NFC playoff. And he just hasn't been able to get the job done in the course of 28-3 collapse.
Your New England Patriots. It's okay. You can say it, your New England Patriots.
I didn't want to be that guy, but yeah, my New England Patriots. And then we see you had Marino. So Marino went to one Super Bowl, and they just ran into a chainsaw of an offense, being Joe Montana. That Niners offense might have been the best offense out of any of those Niners Super Bowls. Honestly, they were as well balanced as you possibly could have imagined. They were so, so, so good. That Niners offense was unreal. So I kind of give Dan Marino a pass on that one. But he hasn't been in a ton of AFC championship games. And that might be, I mean, I think that might be at times his fault, but I also think the AFC was loaded, really loaded. Jim Kelly went to four straight Super Bowls, dude. Four straight. And he couldn't come out with one of them. In fact, the Washington one, he played horrible. And when they played Dallas and Pasadena, they lost like 52-10.
Yeah, the Dallas ones were ugly.
Also horrible.
Well, he played bad. The Dallas ones, I think you give him a pass because those Dallas teams were good. Jimmy Johnson, I think, is one of my favorite coaches. But the
No. I'm not giving him a pass. No way.
No? I was going to say the Giants one and the Washington one to me are more condemnable because I feel like they were very winnable teams. But, again, Ajay's a Patriots fan, and if you watch the 30 for 30, which I recommend you do, Four Falls of Buffalo, they talk about how they broke down the keg on offense and figured out a way to kind of stop it. And for as intelligent and as talented as that Buffalo team was, I think that the Giants one to me might be the worst one just from the standpoint of the Giants really didn't do anything that elaborate. Granted, they had LT, which helps. But other than that, I don't feel like they did anything amazing. They just figured him out and had a scheme.
Yeah, the thing is that instead of blitzing like they were so aggressively doing throughout the season, it just dropped the guys back.
Everybody.
Kelly had no one to go to. Like, he just was, like, everyone was covered. And so they went to the running game with Thurman Thomas, and it actually worked. They ate up the clock and they were gaining yards. But, yeah, that was a tough one, too. And then who I have? James Harden. Dude, I don't know. James Harden I don't even think he belongs on this list. I don't.
Well, I mean, if you make the argument, let's see, Stockton, Malone, Finals, Marino, Super Bowl, Jim Kelly, four, man. I mean, everybody else has been to a Super Bowl. No. James Harden's been to what, two Western Conference Finals? He went to a Finals once with the Thunder.
But, dude, that was like revenge LeBron James. That was not happening. They were not going to win that series.
So to get this correct, you have Stockton and Malone as the least biggest chokers and Harden at the bottom as the biggest choker.
Oh, wait. No, I have Stockton and Malone as the biggest chokers.
They're the biggest chokers. I'm making sure I got your order right. Interesting. So the fact that he hasn't got to a finals, you still put him at the bottom of the list. That's really interesting.
Yeah, because Stockton and those guys had a chance, and they still found a way to suck.
Well, I just want everyone to know, as a Utah Jazz fan, you should give Ajay a ton of credit because, obviously, the Jazz and Houston got a bit of a rivalry simmering, and he still says James Harden, out of that list of great players, is the least choker. Matt Ryan, John Stockton, and Malone, Marino, and Jim Kelly. Wow. I thought for sure you were going to have him at number one.
Yeah, I have Stockton, Malone. The way they just can never get the job done, and when the bigger the game got, the worse they got.
Are you going to be allowed back in Utah?
Oh, yeah. Because if you don't agree, then you're being overly biased.
Okay.
You take off your goggles, you know?
I'm all for being critical of your team. I think that's the difference between a smart fan and a meatball fan is a phrase in my family. So, so that's the ranking in the close call legacy club. How about cursed franchises? Because I was thinking about this, putting this together. You and I, when we did the show on The Fan, the Full Court Press, talked about Minnesota ad nauseum the day that I filled in. And then, of course, I think you got to talk about Cincinnati Bengals. Do you think clubs can be cursed? Because it's not personnel, because the Bengals and the Twins losing streak in the postseason has gone on so long. So it can't be personnel. It can't be coaching. You can make the argument maybe ownership, definitely maybe culture. So can you be cursed as a franchise? I'm also asking as a Cubs fan.
I put the Cleveland Indians in there, too.
Ooh, all right. I'll throw another one down for you. You want to pile on, I'm all for it. Run up the score.
No, I think about it. I'm trying to think. Was it 95 they lost to Atlanta? 97 they lost in 7 to Florida? And then 16, and then they had a couple of shots there in the ALCS. Oh, and they didn't ever get anything done. Oh, that's the World Series. That poor franchise can't find any. And the Vikings, too. Actually, you said Minnesota Twins, but the Vikings in there. Culpepper, right? Moss, Carter.
Just piling on. All right, which teams do I think really can't get it done? So then, okay, tell me, is your argument, is you're putting together, you're adding to this list here, can you be cursed as a franchise, or is it just bad luck?
I'm going to say it's bad luck.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's bad luck.
Do you think
don't you remember it was Morton Anderson who had never missed a field goal inside of a dome? And when they played Atlanta in the NFC Championship and he shanked it left?
Yep.
At home, dude. Like, how do you explain that?
I think that's what the Minnesota Miracle was against the Saints. It was a little bit of that bad luck coming out the other end.
Here's a little karma for you.
There you go.
And then basically they went back to Minnesota because then they went to Philly the next week and got absolutely trounced.
I remember that.
Okay, so bad luck. Fair enough. I think here, different question then. Do you think it can carry more weight in certain sports? Because to me, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong and thinking of baseball the wrong way, but I feel like the traditionalist roots of baseball have it so that that can have a little bit more impact. Because you brought up the Indians, the freaking Twins. I mean, theirs is legendary. We saw a bunch of those snap this year. I mean, obviously, the Dodgers got their first World Series since 88. The A's and the White Sox played each other, and neither of them had won a playoff series in 15 years or something like that. I mean, you're talking some interesting streaks that were broken. Is it possible that it carries more weight in different sports, the bad luck or curse, depending on how you feel about it?
Nah, I think it all feels the same, right?
Interesting.
So you can't win. You can't win the big one. I think it all feels the same. But, I mean, you being a diehard Cubs fan, you might feel opposite of that.
Yeah, I think curses exist. I think especially in baseball, it feels like curses exist. How else do you explain the freaking Marlins? Finally, the Braves knocked them out, but at that point, they'd never lost a playoff series. Cursed with success, jerks. While we're on baseball, we got Tony Parks of KJazz, KMYU, Salt Lake City, formerly a Jazz sideline reporter, and of course, the Tony Parks podcast. Thank you so much for being on with us.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
Awesome. So we've talked about LA a lot in this podcast, and I feel like any baseball fan, maybe a little bit more than casual, knows the attachment that Clayton Kershaw's had to him as a postseason choker. To you, what is winning the World Series finally and playing pretty well, specifically in the World Series, but pretty well throughout the postseason this year, mean for his legacy?
Well, I think it means a ton. I mean, winning a championship is big, and him playing really well on the biggest stage is going to be very big. I mean, we all know, and I mean, look, he would have gone down as a great pitcher, Hall of Fame pitcher. His best was better than anybody else throughout most of the years that he would have been involved, you know, in Major League Baseball. But look, at the end of the day, you know, we all love a regular season guy, but no one's going to celebrate a regular season guy the same way something like the postseason. And the fact that he shined, and the fact that that team as well, which that group, let's be honest, had a lot of deep runs and then had weird ways of getting in their own way to keep them from achieving ultimate glory, with the exception of the Astros in 17, we all know. But the point is, this team had unique flaws or weird ways of ill-timed mistakes that came back to hurt them, and they finally were able to put it together, down 3-1, rally back to win the LCS, and then they win the World Series. You know, they've been the best team before, but now they were the best team with a guy who is the best pitcher who then goes on to win the World Series. So without that crown, I'm with you. Something very critical would have been missing from his career, as well as the Dodgers, this group all together. So it doesn't just do something great for Kershaw's legacy, but that entire group.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. He's won basically every individual award. It would have been, I think, incomplete is the best word. You brought up the Astros, and I wanted to ask you about that, because now AJ Hinch is back. He's not in Houston. He's with Detroit, and Alex Cora just happened to sign back this week as well with Boston. What do you make of that? Too little punishment? It's confusing just because the players really didn't receive any. It was the coach and the GM. Good for baseball, bad for baseball? What do you think?
Bad, in my opinion, that it was too light. That something that can go into what is blatant cheating and bush league behavior, and to be handed off with such soft punishment, and then kind of a shrug shoulders, okay, we move along. All that did was say, hey, if you don't think you're going to get caught, go for it. Now, I mean, it's just like anything else. The reason why people cheat is they think they can do it and not get caught.
Of course.
They thought they could do it and not get caught. Well, now it's do it if you don't think you'll get caught. And if you do get caught, it doesn't matter. It's all going to be, you know, elementary at the end of this thing. I thought that was a terrible message, and I thought Manfred was brutal in the middle of that. I thought the championship should have been removed. I always say the same thing. There's a huge difference between gamesmanship and flat-out cheating. You know, like if you and I are playing cards and I happen to notice your eyes do something, your face does something, or you take your right hand off the cards whenever you have a good hand or something, or you tip something. There's something in your body language. That's gamesmanship. But if I have a mirror behind you that is showing all that shows some of your cards, and now I can strategically make moves based off of that, I might not win every hand, and I may have won the card game anyway. But the fact that I had that edge and created off of something like that, I don't think should ever just be thrown by the wayside. I thought there should have been very stringent punishment.
Yeah, I would agree. And for you, how does this frame the whole – because the big sticking point with the Hall of Fame, of course, has been steroids with Barry Bonds and mm-hmm. all that. So how does the basically non-punishment for the players frame the whole staunch defense against steroids? And I think Pete Rose as well you would throw in there because he's received the lifetime ban.
Yeah. Well, so I've always said the same thing. Let me back it up real quick. The Pete Rose thing, the rule was you do it, you're done for life. He did it. He's done for life. To me, there's no conversation. Like, change the rule, and I'll change my mind. So you might hate the rule, but them's was the rules. I mean, that was it. It was right there in front of your face. So the Pete thing on its own, that's what it is. The PEDs and all that stuff, I always, in some ways, thought it was the most unfair thing in a small way. It was almost like if you drove to work every day, and as you're driving to work, you're, 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, and you wave at the cop on your way to work every day. Now, you're cheating. He knows you're cheating. Both of you understand that. It's still wrong. And then randomly one day, this cop shows up to your front door and drops off, 5 years worth of speeding tickets. It's like, oh, by the way, but I've always believed, cheaters should not be in when it comes to especially the career long. I've always thought when attacking the Astros that it should be attacked in those particular years, right? I mean, those particular years, I think it gets a little muddy, a little murky, but the Rose one to me is definitive. I mean, I can't defend that because it was actually in the rules. You bet on the game, you're done for life. And they had to put that stringent of a rule on it because of gambling, and it was possible that it could ruin baseball many decades before that. That's how the rule was there.
One other manager question for you. The big one that you talk about trying to win, the big one I think that's happened this offseason, besides obviously Cora and Hinch coming back, is La Russa to the White Sox. Now, I'm a Cubs fan, so the White Sox don't necessarily interest me, but I pay enough attention. I personally think that it's the wrong move, I think, for a lot of the reasons. I think that he hasn't coached for a decade. It was a debacle him running Arizona, and now you have this mm-hmm. super young team. Do you feel the same way, or am I wrong and you're on board with that? I think the big argument is he just knows how to win and he'll keep this team in shape.
I remember when Jack McKeon took over there with the Marlins, in May back in 2003, and thought, oh, what are they doing? Because he was 73, I think, is what his age was.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, well, they're just going to get through this and then find their new guy. Well, he was vital to that team going on to win the World Series. And so with Tony, my big thing is, man, can the White Sox have a culture where the understanding is, hey, this guy's in it for win now. Don't worry about how long he's going to be here. This guy knows how to win. Just take things day. I really do wonder, because my initial thought was, no, what are you talking about? No. Why would you do that? How would that ever be a good thing right now? But honestly, so my answer is still no, but it's still Tony La Russa to a point. I do think he will know how to manage a club. I do think that he'll gain the respect of the players. But if adversity does strike, does the player get in the back of his head, how long is this guy really going to be here anyway? Really, managing this team. Is he going to be here for 10 years managing this club? No. Is he going to be here even for 5? I mean, the thought of somebody in their 80s to do that, I don't think so. So when I first heard rumblings about this, I thought, oh, that's a joke. It's not happening. But it did. And I'm with you. I'm not quite so big on this group.
Yeah, and when the other thing, too, that I didn't touch on that I think is a problem as well, as a Chicago fan, I'm quite familiar with Jerry Reinsdorf, and it seems like all reports coming out are that Reinsdorf wanted him, the front office didn't,
And to me, that's just as much a big indicator of a problem as well, because look what the front office has done with this team in the span of, what, two and a half years. They've put together a wild card team, granted in the expanded playoffs, but a very exciting young team. I would like to think that they know kind of what they're doing and what they're looking for management-wise, and so that, to me, just would seem to further drive a rift where, like, owner and LaRusso on one side and players and front office are on the other.
Right, right. And that's one area where this thing might not work. You know, like what you're talking about there, I think is huge, because can you have all three with all the trains on the tracks going the same direction? Because if you're not going to have that, I think it could be a situation where it gets soured. And I like what you pointed out, to credit that they've got some good young talent. You know, it wasn't that long ago this team wasn't worth a food stamp. And now, you know, in a very short amount of time, they have a little something to work with there. You know, they're not so bad. But it's interesting on this part of their growth, because you know, you're a Cubs fan. I'm a Cubs fan. I watched where the Cubs even had some years where maybe the team wasn't excellent, but you could see some young talent coming along in what was going on with a good GM and an owner that knew how to pay the money and stay out of the way, and then a good quality manager to go with it. And when all three of those were moving the right direction, then you saw what was a good young group of players turn into an excellent group of players. And then guys from the minor leagues coming up that people didn't even know about yet, and things like that happening. And they won a World Series a lot faster than I had expected, to be honest with you. For the White Sox, if that disconnect is there, I think it's sad, because you could take some really promising players here and a group that's done well, I think, in their minor league system with drafting and all of that. I mean, I think they have a lot of the ingredients to break through in the next few years to then be, you know, a team that needs to be reckoned with. But if that disrupts something like that growth and that possibility, I think that's a shame. Now, I'm glad it's happening to the White Sox, because it's going to happen to anybody. But like, when I look at the team, because it was part of me that was like, no, it's not going to work. And then they hired him, and I went, yeah, well, it's going to work for me. You know, but you understand the rivalry.
Yeah, I got you.
Getting serious about it. So the age is one thing, but the disconnect in what you're talking about there, I've seen it hurt NBA teams, NFL teams. I've seen it magnify and galvanize a young team to take off if you connect the right people with it. But that disconnect could end up being something to sour what I think is a good young core, and that would be disappointing.
Different sport, but in what you said with you seeing that disconnect affecting good young NBA teams, what's the biggest slip-up then of the coach or the team? What's their number one mistake, or is there something consistent you see that is the issue behind that?
Oh, I've seen it in the NBA where I think, like, you know, Stan Van Gundy, I thought, did a great job with Orlando, you know, and there's clear disconnect on exactly what each piece wanted and how it was going to go forward. And it was very clear. And now they even contended for a title. But I still remember being around that team, and you could clearly see a good, talented team that was not just underperforming, but was disconnected in so many different ways, right? And I think you really have to understand everybody in the room and their perspective and what it's going to take to win, you know? And sometimes a GM may not want to listen to the coach, but it's like, well, hold on a second. I know you hired him, but you hired him to run that stuff. Trust his feedback here, right? I think sometimes an owner can step in and think they know a little bit more than they actually do. Jerry Jones, I think, is maybe the best example ever of an organization that, man, if can you imagine if he and Jimmy stay together like that and trust one another and it turns into synergy and all that? I mean, they could have owned the 90s. I mean, they were the team of the 90s. Essentially, but they could have like owned the 90s, and you see that. And I think it's really unique when you see it happen, because I'm curious to know just how much lost excellence has ever been there from certain teams.
Interesting.
Solely based on either ego, ignorance, lack of trust, you know, just the basic things. So talent, organization, these are all smart people. But sometimes too many smart people in the room, everyone starts to battle on who thinks who's the smartest, and that can end up being a bad thing for a group.
So based on your perspective, that raises, I think, a good question for me. So for Tony La Russa and what you saw in Orlando as your experience, is the biggest challenge for him going to be relating to the younger players or making sure the game hasn't passed him by? Because I think you could make the argument Van Gundy his team, those Orlando teams, kind of fit the NBA now because they just surrounded Dwight with a bunch of shooters. So
right.
he was kind of
ahead of everybody.
Yeah, he was kind of ahead of that. But it's, from what you're saying to me, it seems like there was a real disconnect with his team. So for La Russa, with analytics and the shifts and all that becoming such a bigger part of baseball, is it that since he's been out of management for a decade, or do you think it is the relating to younger players, which seems to be kind of a consistent theme for people who don't like the hire?
See, I think he can relate to the younger players. I think I think he can connect to them in ways to help them understand what it takes to win, right? Everybody wants to play and win, but not everybody wants to work and compete. This guy's had a great formula of success for a really long time. So I don't think that he'll struggle to stay connected, but I do wonder in the other element there what it's going to take. If you've got some guy jamming down your throat some theoretical that these numbers mean this and these numbers mean that. We saw it in the World Series, which I thought was a travesty, and it's not the biggest reason they lost Game 6, but still, we saw what happened in Game 6 of the World Series, where I think they allowed something outside of the game to start dictating the actual game. And Tony is a guy that I don't think he's going to refuse to ever do the shift. I don't think he's going to – like, I think he'll be semi-adaptable. But if somebody's going to come to him and say – oh, based on these projections, blah, 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 Tony could be the guy that says, yes, but I've been around him. I've talked to him. I've connected with him here. I trust him there. And I think you can see Tony going on to do things. I mean, that 06 team had no business winning the World Series. They did. That 11 team was really, really good there in St. Louis. And you know, they were knocking on elimination's door. And they got it done. I mean, you saw him with plenty of teams that you actually looked at some of the rosters and you're like, all right, there's some studs. But look what he got out of some of these other guys. You know, I do think that there's some positive there with Tony and his baseball knack altogether in being around personnel. I think that's one of the things that helped him be successful.
Two last things for you here, Tony, before we let you go. And thanks again for being on with us. With you being down in Salt Lake, tell me, because Ajay's been on this camp up here in northern Utah. BYU, are they legit?
Define legit. Let's start there.
Are they a top 15 team? Could they potentially be a playoff/New Year's Six team?
Okay, so the first one, yes. The second one, no. The third one, yes. So they are not. It's very difficult in college football. You have 130 teams, and I know that Utah's now not playing this weekend. We got other teams canceled. Conventionally, 130 teams, a limited number of games, four playoff spots, a voting system to determine all of that. It is very tough when non-Power 5 teams play a non-Power 5 schedule and dominate it and then want Power 5 top four national level respect. It's tough. So whenever I was doing the AP voting, the one thing that I did was I would always say it's not just about who you play, it's how you play. So I had Gonzaga basketball number one for a while. I was kind of one of the first people to put them up there the year they went to the final and lost because it was about how they were playing. Football is the most more difficult than basketball in that way for me to be able to just evaluate that on its own, to be like, all right, it's Western Kentucky, but how do I perceive this going up against better talent? And it was very, very difficult, and it's very hard to gauge that with BYU. With faster players and more capable athletes, deeper teams that they would face, let's say, week in and week out, if I measured them up with the Power 5 week in and week out thing, well, Oklahoma State lost to Iowa State. That was the same kind of week BYU had against UTSA. BYU wins, Oklahoma State loses. So both of them have had, in my opinion, you could look at and say, a similar sort of quality level performance from start to finish, and you can get into the other semantics. But the point is, you can't say, oh, well, we caught the break with the lucky part in the schedule, but win's a win. No, not in college football. So playoffs, no. I think we can leave that train at the station. New Year's Six, they couldn't have picked a better year for this because there's going to be five at-large bids that are up for grabs outside of even the G5 auto bid because the other four games outside of the playoffs, they have the least amount of other conference obligations, right? So 2 years from now, you have, I think, six of the eight spots would be occupied by auto bids or conference obligations where there's connection there. So I look at it and say, man, BYU picked a perfect year for this, whereas, say, last year, Utah, right, outperformed Virginia, but since conference affiliation matters, Virginia goes to the Orange Bowl, Utah does not. Virginia's perceived as having a more achieved season when it wasn't true.
No.
So the other part is BYU could go undefeated and not get in a New Year's Six. I think it'd be a travesty, but it could happen. Like, there's so much up in the air. But when they say, are they for real, is this a premier team in the country, top 10? Yes. Yeah, top 10, top 15, no doubt. And I think that even if they played a really good P5 team, even if I wouldn't pick them against Georgia, I think they would show better than people think.
Interesting. The last thing I was supposed to ask you was to dial up Coach Lou and have him give us his thoughts on Clemson and Notre Dame, one of the huge matchups this weekend.
Well, the first thing you got to understand, Tracy Lawrence is the best quarterback in the country, and I think he's going to be really tough to go up against, okay? And he's going to say things like, paint me a Birmingham. And he's going to go out there and say, guys, you got to do what it takes to go beat these teams. But you don't know who the number one team should be in the country, and that's the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame. I'm telling you right this second, right now, that Jim Kelly's done a fabulous job since he arrived there. He knows how to coach the quarterbacks. He knows how to coach the receivers. He knows how to coach every single person out there. And when I see a team like that, Clemson, coming in there, those kitty cats don't stand a chance. The Bengals are in trouble, and I think it's going to be Notre Dame winning by a rout. On the other hand, Michigan is not going to win another game the entire season, and I'll tell you why. Because Michigan sucks. That's why they couldn't do anything out there. They were absolutely terrible against Michigan State. And the other thing I'm going to tell you right here, right now, is the fact that I would rather eat a burnt piece of French toast that's been sitting on today for 2 days at a Flying J than to watch Michigan football. That team is about as useful as a screen door on a submarine, and people are going to see it the rest of the year.
That was so good.
Just for you, man.
Thank you so much, Coach Lou and Tony Parks. Tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah, notice I said thanks for having us.
Yeah.
We are glad to join
you. I'm very glad to have the both of you as well.
And, you know, I'm Tim Kirchens happy to be. I mean, it's so great to be a part of the show. I mean, and Lou Holtz impersonation. Who does that? I can't believe what I'm watching. But I talked to Joe Madden, and he said, well, that's just the way we are. All right. Find me with the Tony Parks podcast. Trying to do it as frequently, as possible with great different stuff and college football. Wasn't able to do as much baseball stuff this year, but hoping for next season to have more regular routine with that. It's been a crazy year. Follow me on all forms of social media at TonyParks801, and feel free to ever email me, TonyParks801@gmail.com. Man, this was fun.
So Tony Parks and Coach Lou gave us great perspective on BYU and Clemson Notre Dame, but expanding on that, Ajay, I've got a conspiracy theory here for you. So Clemson's at Notre Dame tomorrow, and they're playing without Trevor Lawrence. Now, Clemson's one of the conferences that says we're not doing divisions, it's just the two best teams will play each other. And at this point, seems like it's going to be Clemson Notre Dame. My conspiracy theory is the ACC wants Notre Dame to win because – as we'll get to, the fourth best team, no one has any idea. And Notre Dame's definitely not going to get in the playoffs if they lose to Clemson twice. But because of Clemson's reputation and Lawrence being out, I think they could lose this one on the road, then beat Notre Dame in the ACC championship game and possibly push both of them in either 2-3, 3-4, but both into the playoff spot. What do you think?
But here's the thing is how does everybody else finish out, right? Because how does Bama, Ohio State, I don't know what happens with the Pac-12. They're in a huge, huge mess right now. But if USC or Oregon comes out on top and they're undefeated, look, I love your theory. And it worked with the SEC, and I believe in 2011 when Alabama had lost to LSU 9-6, claiming the SEC championship, and then just absolutely beat the crap out of them. But, man, I don't know if that would work now. I honestly don't, especially the way this is. But I can see your point. And that, by the way, that game's going to be the focus of a later segment we're going to do in a little bit.
That's fair. That's a good choice.
Yeah.
Okay, well then, on that subject, then tell me this, because obviously the question that would probably prelude that is right now, who's the fourth best team in the country to you? Because I think most people, maybe not consistently, but I think most people would put Clemson, Alabama, and Ohio State in some order. So who's four? Because Notre Dame's been sitting there, and they've got the opportunity to show tomorrow. Who's four?
I'd go Bama, Clemson, Ohio State, Notre Dame in that order. In that order exactly. But if there's a fifth team sitting on the outside looking in, it's got to be Georgia. Georgia's really good. Georgia's going to give Bama a run for their money. I have Georgia.
Georgia's
just behind fourth.
Georgia's problem is what Notre Dame's could potentially be. They already played and lost, but they potentially, there's a big one this week. Obviously, Georgia plays Florida. And that's a big one for figuring out who's going to win the East, but the same kind of chance. I'm with you. I think Georgia is probably my fifth best team, but I don't think they can afford to lose to potentially and probably Bama twice. Talking about the playoffs, we've seen it. We saw it in baseball. We saw it in hockey. We saw it's sort of an extended version in basketball. Did college football miss a chance this year to expand the playoffs? Or in this COVID season with all the threats, was that maybe not the – it didn't matter?
So, at least for this year. At least for this year they should have and they didn't. And that's a shame. But I get it. I mean, revenue and money and such. I mean, you gotta, and I just don't know how many fans you'll be able to have. I mean, the Super Bowl, AJ's gonna have 20% capacity. The Super Bowl, dude, it's gonna have 20% capacity. That's nuts. And so, it sucks. And I get it. But, it's a problem and I feel bad. And I think that you would have seen a very competitive playoff this year. I honestly do.
I think it's a big whiff. I think last year my Hall of Shame nominee was the NCAA because basically they choose not to lead, and this is one of those cases where I think lack of leadership is a problem. And granted, the College Football Committee is separate from the NCAA, but I think they could have came together and said, look, here's the deal. Unlike most seasons, we're not going to have the non-conference games. Who knows how many games certain teams are going to get to play with the COVID stuff. Let's expand the playoffs so we can have a concise answer. Now, at this point in time, as we just talked about who's the fourth best team, maybe it won't matter because who's taking up the fourth mantle. But I asked Tony about BYU. You've been on BYU. I'd like to throw Cincinnati in there as well. That, I think, is the problem. I think one of the bigger reasons why not expanding the playoffs is going to hurt because it was a chance, I think, to get some of those group of fives in. And frankly, I think we're just heading further and further to Power Five needs to go do its own playoff, and Group of Five needs to do its own.
Yeah, I think they should allow. See, and that's a great point you bring up. That's a solid point you bring up. I mean, BYU's going to be competitive. Boise's going to be competitive. Cincinnati's going to be competitive. One of those teams deserves a shot as well. That's a great point you bring up. And you know what? On my hot take of the year, I think if it's Boise State or BYU, I think they would. I think they'd be probably the national championship.
I mean, Tony said, he said he thinks they're a legit top 10 team. He just says the problem is their schedule. I mean, we'll see tonight. We got Boise and BYU. Let's talk COVID real fast here for college football. So there's a bunch of games canceled this weekend. Pac-12 is supposed to get started, game canceled. My Purdue Boilermakers not playing one of their premier games of schedule against Wisconsin, their second game canceled. Obviously, this seemingly, I feel like, has kind of skated through okay. SEC, ACC, Big 12 have seemingly been good. Big 10 starting to hit some hiccups. Pac-12 not left the station very well. What do you think is college football as a whole managing COVID well? Two, what's your confidence level we're going to finish the season?
Depends on the conference. I don't think Pac-12 is going to get in. In fact, I don't even know if Utah gets in.
Yeah.
You know, let's see, how many games do they schedule? Six?
Six, seven. Yeah, I think that's something. Six, seven.
I think they play two less than that. I think they're going to have another game canceled.
That is nothing.
That's my take. And I don't think the Pac-12 makes it. There's too many issues right now. I just don't see them making it through.
Yeah, it did seem.
Which means,
go ahead.
No, sorry. So I Big 12 never pulled off, and somehow the SEC's pulled it off. You know, Mountain West, as I know, is having a few issues of their own too. But yeah, I don't think the Pac-12 is going to be able to pull it off. But it's taking a beating, and like I said, maybe that's why I think we should have expanded playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, it did seem like the Pac-12 came in begrudgingly, and I think so too, because while you say, okay, the who knows the fourth best team? Again, I think that you could have expanded it. It just seemed, because I think we've seen hockey, baseball, they really expanded theirs. They had good results. NBA kind of expanded just a little bit with that ninth seed thing, and they seem like they want to make that permanent. I mean, it's a weird year. Do what you can. See, and if it doesn't work, you say, well, you know, we tried it, and it didn't work. Because everyone thinks that the playoffs expanding is inevitable anyway.
Yeah. You know, and that sucks too. And you know, I think if you expand it, you give, you know, kind of like I said, a couple more opportunities for really be like, I'm really intrigued by BYU. I seriously, to heaven, think they're a much, much better football team than people are giving them credit for. I think Zach Wilson's a great quarterback. I think they have a great defense. They're very physical. They're very talented on the offensive side of the ball. I, honest to heaven, I think that they would give any team a run for their money in the country. Clemson is the exception to that if Trevor Lawrence is playing any company.
I mean, you're really trying hard not to get invited back to Northern Utah. First you say Stockton and Malone are the biggest chokers. Now you say BYU's legit and could win a national championship. I mean, you're really trying hard here.
Just telling you the truth, man.
Well, I'll tell you this. Before we get to the Hall of Shame, I brought an honorable mention, which I know is cheating, but my number one is a whole football conference. So just so you know that. But before that, touch on NBA real fast. We talked about this a lot last week. We had the amazing Dan Clayton in to talk about NBA specifically. You and I went back and forth on the schedule, and it looks like the NBA agreed and is going to push through what they originally suggested. Doesn't look like there's really any budging. December 22nd, 72 games, going all the way. And I'm still in the same camp that I was last week. Huge mistake. I know they want to make up revenue. I think it's going to backfire because players are just going to sit out.
Yeah. How many star players do it to, you know, Kawhi, LeBron, is obviously aging up. Giannis, I think, will sit out a few games. Who else? I think KD sits out a few games, to be honest with you.
Well, he's coming off the ACL, the Achilles, too, so yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think Steph Curry will sit out a few games. Again, you're going to see a lot of star guys sit out a few games, but it's also going to give some of these younger guys a chance to play, and I think for the NBA teams, that's what's more important, is giving these young guys reps to see what you got on your roster and what you can make of them. For us fans, it will suck, but I think at the same time you get basketball, it comes right over Christmas Day, which is beautiful for us basketball diehard fans, and then you'll still get good games, honestly, you will. Financially, it was great. It was great for the players. I think that's what kind of sold them on this. It's the financial impact. If they would have waited until January instead of playing in December, was the huge money they would have lost, which the NBA's already lost that on a billionaire or something like that, 10%. So, yeah, and they don't want to take any more of a financial hit. So. Might as well just start then.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think I thought it was inevitable. That's what I felt like last week. So when it came out, it surprised me a little bit that they weren't able to knock it down a smidge. And then really, the December 22nd start, I know players have come out and said it's too quick a turnaround, but I think for the NBA, I get that. Christmas has kind of been their big marketing day. I'm just surprised at the games. I'm surprised the Players Union couldn't knock them down a few games because they're, starting month and a half later and they're going to play 10 less games. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Brutal. Yeah.
It'll be different. I think it's going to look different. It's going to feel different, but you know, you get to March and there's still games that are matters.
The question will be, is that good enough to make it in the Hall of Shame?
Ooh.
Easier to get into than the NFL Hall of Fame.
Here we go.
It's the Hall of Shame.
Who is this guy?
It's our Hall of Shame, AJ and AJ, from the Bleachers podcast. Last week, it was Bill O'Brien for AJ, the NCAA for me. Who will join them this week, AJ?
as just terrible, terrible people or poorly run, terrible decisions. Whatever your qualifications on, you just get to shame them and say bad things about them. Who makes it this week?
Man, this is hard. You know, I'm the biggest Bill Belichick fan there possibly is. I mean, I even read the transcripts of his press conferences. But what's going on now is just an absolute just crap hole. Like,
it's rough.
You know, I mean, they lose Jimmy Garoppolo, you know, and then they get Cam Newton, and that's not working out. Stephon Gilmore's getting beat everywhere, and it's just, I mean, it's an issue all over New England's football field right now, and I'm going to put Cam Newton in the Hall of Shame.
Wow.
I'm extremely disappointed with him. Extremely disappointed with him. I think he hasn't made good reads. He's holding on the ball too long. He's not moving around the pocket like he used to. He can hold on to the ball, period. Like, when he gets hit, he loses it. His rating is worse so far of his career. His passer rating, I should say. Just no movement, no liveliness, no energy. Cam Newton's in the Hall of Shame.
Wow. Okay. Needless to say that I would imagine the Monday Night Football, in sympathy to the marketing department for ESPN, but the Monday Night Football game of the Jets and the Patriots not on your what to watch this weekend list, huh?
I'll still watch because I have to, because I am the, you know, I am the number one fan. So I'll still watch it. Doesn't mean I like it.
Again, sympathy to the marketing department. How do you build that one up? They're terrible. Watch. See who's worse. For my Hall of Shame, honorable mention goes to John Harbaugh because he is who we thought he is. Cue Dennis Green on that one because they beat Minnesota, which now looks like not as big a deal because Minnesota got beat by Maryland. And then they get physically dominated by Michigan State. But to me, the Hall of Shame goes to the Big 12. Look, I think they're generally overrated. I kind of despise Texas because I feel like they're generally overrated. But this conference took about, 4 weeks to let us know, hey, we're not going to be in the playoffs this year. Oklahoma and Texas did it pretty much immediately. Not only did they knock themselves out of the national championship contention, within about 2 straight weeks, they're like, hey, don't even consider us for the New Year's Six. We ain't going to be there. And then Oklahoma State, which I tweeted, you can go back and find it. I tweeted after Oklahoma and Texas, I believe, lost their second one. I said, well, the Big 12's done because I don't think Okie State's going to run the table. What do? They go to a Texas team that's floundering, and they lose. Big 12, pathetic. You get to replace the Pac-12 this year, no matter what happens in the Pac-12, because in a year where nobody can figure out who in the heck is the fourth team for the playoff, you're like, you know what? We're just going to bow out now. Don't even consider us. We don't want it. We're not here.
Man, you sound angry.
I mean, generally, I don't particularly care for any of the Big 12 teams, but I think it's pretty pathetic they couldn't keep anyone in past like 5 weeks into the season. So lastly, that raises up, we already touched on one big college football game. What are you watching this weekend, AJ?
Yeah. Clemson and Notre Dame. It's going to be really delicious. It's going to be really, really delicious. But that's going to be a really good football game. And with Lawrence out, I think it plays into Notre Dame's hands. They're going to have to establish a running game. They're going to have to be physical. Line of scrimmage. They're going to have to put some pressure on this quarterback. He's a freshman, but he played like a senior last week. I thought he was really good. Had good arm accuracy. You know, with calm, cool, and collective in the pocket. But man, I got Notre Dame winning that game. But that's one I keep my eyes on.
You know, it's funny. I looked at the line for this game yesterday, so it might have changed because I haven't seen it today. But I was thinking, oh, with Lawrence out and it being in South Bend, I'll bet on Clemson because I feel they're a pretty solid team, and if I win, I win. I went and looked. The line yesterday was still Clemson -5.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, that will go down. That should go down.
It threw me for a loop, so I put $5 on Notre Dame because I was like, well, I feel like Notre Dame's actually the choice here, but I couldn't believe the line was that big. For what to watch, a couple honorable mentions. BYU and Boise is tonight. That one's definitely worth considering to see how good either program is. Obviously, BYU steamrolling their season. For tomorrow, another one to consider. Not as important as Clemson Notre Dame, but I think a big deal still nonetheless to see who's going to compete potentially with Alabama for the SEC championship game. Florida is at Georgia, and that's a contentious rivalry. But since you picked college football, I'm going to go Saints and Bucks Sunday night. Breeze and Brady keep trading the touchdown pass record. I think that's interesting.
The Bucks kind of had a stinker against the Giants. They still beat them, but mostly I think because they're the Giants. The Saints are interesting because a lot of people had them as a favorite this year. Everyone's pretty sure it's Drew Brees' last year, and they're just – they're a weird team. Thomas can't stay healthy. He gets – punches his teammate. The secondary's atrocious. Drew Brees' arm strength is in question. Their wide receivers keep getting hurt. They pulled it out against the Bucks early in the season, I think, because the Bucks are still figuring out. This one's a big one. I think it'll tell me, are the Saints a legit Super Bowl contender, or are they just going to be a playoff team?
I'll find out, I think, Sunday. You know, if you ask me, it's kind of where it's developed as a rivalry between those two teams.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see. I wouldn't be surprised to see them meet up in the playoffs again. But a lot of big games for playoffs across college and pro football. So definitely a lot of good choices when it comes to what to watch. And for AJ, you know, he gets to watch the heartbreak Monday of the Patriots-Jets again. Wonderful. And then last night you got a bird's eye view up close and personal with the Aggies. So your sports weekend's just going swimmingly.
Yeah. It's been rough. It's been rough. That's an understatement.
Well, I think you should run the sweep more. If I could add my two cents to your coaching, I think you should run the sweep more.
For Aggies or for Patriots?
Everybody.
Okay, just want to make sure. We ran the sweep yesterday, off a total of 452 yards doing that.
Okay,
so,
see, well, that's why you're there helping out with the team and I'm here. Safe travels back, and I hope that your fandom picks up in the next week or two. I do feel for you. Your teams aren't playing.
If it does, then I'm quitting the podcast. I just want you to know that. I'm out. I'm done.
That's
the curse.
That's fair.
It's a curse.
That's fair. That's
podcast curse.
That's AJ Salveson. I'm AJ Knight, and this is From the Bleachers.